Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
It's spring, and what better way to put a spring in your step than by buying some comfy knickers or pants? That is how it works, right? I mean, when I was a kid, if you bought new trainers, then everyone said you'd be able to run faster. So I guess if you buy new pants, then you might be able to put a spring in your... Oh, no, bum. Okay, that's wrong. Yes, anyway, while we all know the wonderful British boxers do an incredible range of things to sleep in, it's now nearly sunny outside again, you know, in that way where it's also a bit cold, but you're still going to need a new T-shirt, hoodie or new pants to go and try it in before you then have to go back inside and get your jacket. And British boxers have a brilliant range of all of those things, as well as pyjamas that you're probably still going to need for work until at least 2023. British boxers are an independent, ethically excellent lot who make actually nice lounge and casual wear that you can wear inside or outside, but you know, with shoes on as well, because you're sensible. Head to british-boxers.com and use the code PARPOLBRO10 and you'll get 10% off whatever you order. You might accuse me of being in the pockets of big pyjama, and I'd say no, actually I take a medium, and my pockets have an old tissue in, because that's tradition, it's just always there. I don't even know where it's come from. It's really strange, it's every pyjama pocket, it's always an old tissue. How does it get there? Who's put it there? Hello and welcome to the Partly Political Broadcast, the comedy and politics podcast that is never afraid to joke about flags or any other fabric decorative adornments, including bunting, banners and tapestries, because to me, it's just all good comedy material. I'm Tiernan Dewey-Ebb, and this week, as the Scientific Pandemic Influenza Group on Modelling advises that the UK faces a real risk if people travel abroad this summer, I assume that's because they'd get a glimpse of how much better everywhere else is right now and absolutely refuse to come back. It's lucky that the Olympics are going ahead this year, isn't it? As currently the UK government and many of its supporters are prime contenders for winning the gold medal in mental gymnastics, despite all the twists and giant leaps required to truly excel. I'm really envious right now of people's ability to scream, "They've cancelled free speech!" at someone like a distressed banshee, while at the same time wanting the death penalty to be brought back for anyone who insults a piece of material that they feel precious about. Or anyone who wishes the army could be sent in to fire at protesters who are just protesting for the right to protest, while at the same time they complain that we live in a nanny state because you can't go on holiday abroad. Whilst also overlooking that the government have reduced the army by 10,000 troops, so if they were sent in to shoot protesters, they'd also not be able to guard the borders from all the children they think are actually terrorists, whose evil plan to destroy Britain involves having no access to benefits and being stuck in a former army barracks with no running water. Or being able to think that billions of pounds should be spent on new nuclear weapons in order to defend against the increasing threat of cyber warfare, as though you can just explode the cloud rather than kill everyone creating your own mushroom ones. Or that Scotland's First Minister and what if Playmobil made a figure of your aunt, Nicola Sturgeon, would have had to resign if it was found she'd misled Parliament by supporting women who'd said they'd been harassed, whereas the Prime Minister and man-thing in a chicken suit, Boris Johnson, failing to report a donation of £60,000 just to make his flat all nice, and let's face it, that probably only just covers the stains he makes sitting on things, that's fine, and the fact you've even brought it up is just pathetic political bias and absolutely typical of you lot. Or that the Conservatives should definitely take over local government in Liverpool because there have been terrible allegations of corruption, and actually the allegations of corruption against the government just means that they might be able to spot it more quickly. Or thinking that because half the population, including you, have had the vaccine, we should all be allowed to do absolutely everything again. And what do you mean, what about the other half? Who? What are you talking about? Hey now, you only needed 52% of the population last time to go ahead with a lack of planning. And the fact that the majority of those who've been jabbed are the same age ranges that voted leave surely means that we can just give it a go. And anyone that complains that their future has been destroyed is obviously just an incompetent young person who should work harder and stop buying avocados so that they can afford their houses that don't exist and aren't affordable. Of course, nuance is often lost in today's political age, and maybe being able to hold two completely and utterly contradictory opinions at once, based entirely on what works for you, isn't illogical, but perhaps some sort of higher state of consciousness that allows you to be happy in this world while the rest of us just feel perpetually defeated. But as ignorance is bliss, I choose never to find out and just assume that a large amount of British people are fucking idiots and will never ever change. On the plus side, at least it's possible to say that our politicians are representative of the public. As if they too couldn't conduct such incredible feats of logic shitting, then how would the Home Secretary and someone who's never had to revise to pass a means test, Priti Patel, remark on protests against the policing bill in Bristol by saying, "Thuggery and disorder by a minority will never be tolerated," just 1 week after she ordered police to beat up a lot of women? Hey, maybe I'm reading that sentence wrong, and as is expected from Patel, emphasis is actually on the by a minority bit, as that's a category of people she never tolerates. The protest started as a peaceful affair against the Policing, Crime, Sentencing and Courts Bill that was voted through its second reading last week by lots of Conservative politicians like MP for Shipley, and exactly who you'd cast if you needed someone to portray a denizen of hell disguised as a person in order to cause chaos on Earth, Philip Davis, who had spent most of his time until last week protesting for free speech at universities where they already have it. Free speech for people to make videos promoting Nazis, or just how COVID regulations restrict people's freedom by not letting them die where they like. Of course, when it comes to actually restricting freedoms, Davis is totes voting for that, as in reality he only likes free speech when it comes from his mouth and is heavily paid for by gambling companies. Former Work and Pensions Secretary and constant proof that if you pick at a spot it gets angry, Ian Duncan Smith, said that he understood that there were issues around freedom of speech and the right to assemble, but overall it's a good bill. Which is a bit like saying that he can see thousands of whirling blades 3 feet off the ground might decapitate kids, but he finds the whirring sound soothing, so hey, it's worth a punt. This is, of course, the same man who wanted the UK to crack down on trade with China due to their breaches of human rights. But it turns out that with his history of letting people with disabilities die, Duncan Smith potentially thinks the actual problem is that China don't go far enough. Ashfield's MP, and what you might draw if I said make a brick racist, Lee Anderson, was only the other week insisting in Parliament that phone-hacking flaccid wattle Piers Morgan should be allowed to stay in the job he willingly quit from because of free speech. He also voted for the policing bill and described the Home Office deporting people to Jamaica as an early Christmas present. Saying that Anderson probably has to say people going away is what he wants from Santa to cover up how he has to spend every December the 25th alone because all of his family think he's an obnoxious prick. It says a lot about the policing bill that one of the only Conservatives who seemed concerned by it was former Prime Minister and proof you can fossilise people, Theresa May, who said she was worried about the unintended consequences of the bill and the power that it gives the Home Office. Exactly, trees. What if it lets them drive around vans with racist slogans on, or decide a whole ton of British people aren't? It was the political version of when a major comic book villain reaches out to the superheroes to say that something worse is coming. She still did vote for it though, because ultimately what's most important is all the intended consequences of it, which May probably wishes that she'd come up with. Yes, the bill does include lots of ways that they say will protect people from crime, but some of those ways now include the government's proposal that to make women feel safer, they'll put plainclothes officers in bars and clubs. Brilliant, because after a policeman was accused of a murder of a young woman, making all the other police officers dress up like their parents get them ready for the club will make all the women in that building feel really safe that if those cops want to harass or abuse them, they'll be at least protected by the spy cops bill and not clog up the court system. See? Everyone's a winner. So look, it makes sense that people would want to protest against this bill in order to be able to protest about anything else ever again. And so Kill the Bill march in Bristol on Sunday seemed like a very reasonable response. Well, unless your name is Bill and you hadn't read the news and you're very worried about what you'd done to cause this. But while it started peacefully, it got pretty violent after riot police turned up with batons, which, as we all know, usually diffuses a situation and makes everyone super zen. I mean, I don't know about you, but if I'm stressed and angry, nothing would soothe my mind like a man in a big helmet running at me with a stick. Especially when the week before, a lot of officers with sticks attacked unarmed women just for feeling unsafe. So a small number of protesters caused trouble by rather violently blocking baton strikes with their faces. Others stupidly fired fireworks into the crowd, which is silly, as by firing them into the sky, everyone would have been distracted and had a nice time instead. And a police van was set fire to, which isn't clever, as with all the cuts to the police force, that's not a renewable energy source. Some police were injured, which isn't good at all, and nor is any injury to anyone or violence full stop. I don't need to say that out loud, you're not stupid. No, those people are too busy on social media to listen to this. But what shouldn't happen, and absolutely will happen, is that the violent bit from Sunday's protest will be used to prove that the policing bill is necessary, like the same way that one kid in your class might have acted up because they'd been largely neglected by the teacher and their valid opinions oppressed, and then the whole class would get detention as a result and you'd all feel angry and work as a unit next time to take down the teacher using grassroots organisations. Sorry, I've got confused. Obviously, people want the streets to be safer, which is why the police only arrested a few people at the anti-lockdown protest marching through London on Saturday, knowing full well that as they didn't wear masks, most of the others should take each other out within weeks, which will save a lot of time and effort. Lockdown is lifting a bit more next week and then a bit more a few weeks after, so protesting about it now just feels like wanting to open up your birthday presents before the day. It's easy to see why people are fed up. I mean, for a start, leading epidemiologist has said that masks and social distancing are likely to be needed for years, which I think is great news for my plans to become a solitary vigilante. And then a government advisory body said summer holidays abroad are unlikely, something that me and my bank balance have known for many years now and really don't need it re-emphasised. Defence Secretary and big eyebrows drawn on a baby, Ben Wallace, has said that there may be an extension to the ban on foreign holidays, which has upset many who are keen to use all the money they'd got from exploiting renters to abuse regulations in other countries where the death toll will matter to them less. Europe appears to be having its third COVID wave, with infection numbers rising so rapidly in Germany, Italy, France, Hungary and Poland, among others, that the UK may end up not even having the worst death rate in the continent. Hooray! Though I'm sure Johnson will see it as the EU being competitive and try his very best to come out on top again. The EU have now decided that the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine is safe to use, and Boris Johnson called leaders to reassure them, which will probably mean that they'll ban it again any minute now. Johnson condemned vaccine nationalism, as it's only all the other types that he approved of, and he got his first jab himself last week and says that he didn't feel a thing, but that may be because, as we all know, he's severely emotionally stunted. Johnson turned up to his jab in a full shirt to be as much of a burden as possible to the nurse, as if he hadn't spent his entire time in number 10 hammering that home already. In contrast, Lord Bethel, who lives entirely on hate, took his whole shirt off for his jab like a toddler in a restaurant. Loads of people joked, but it does explain why Bethel thinks nurses pay us enough for the job they do if the people he usually sees in nurses' costumes require him to get naked and pay afterwards. The NHS have warned that there'll be a significant reduction of vaccine supplies from the end of March, which the Health Secretary and Mr. Poopy Butthole from Rick and Morty, Matt Hancock, responded to during a press briefing where he clearly only found out about it on camera and panicked by saying that vaccine supplies were always going to be lumpy. The sort of comment that really won't reassure any Europeans concerned about getting blood clots from it. The supply issues are apparently India's fault, as the British government seem to be working their way around all the big countries till all they have left to blame is the boogie. I mean, hey, our Prime Minister does idolise Churchill, so I suppose we should have known at some point this would happen. India's stockpile is meant to be for lower income countries, so either the British government is employing the sort of vaccine nationalism I thought it didn't like, or maybe they've had a serious look at our economic future and are actually preparing something in advance for once. The UK is still on course to vaccinate everyone over 50 by April the 15th, reaching a third consecutive record day of vaccinations on Monday by doing 27 jabs a second like eHonda's special move. Nearly 28 million people in the UK have now had their first vaccinations, which is remarkable, but it still means that more than half haven't. Though, as is true form for Steve Baker, the MP who looks like Beaker's humourless brother, much as he did with Brexit, he's not remotely concerned about the welfare of the other half of the country and just wants everything to open up right now. Baker is the head of the COVID recovery group, who keep insisting on making the country recover by doing things that will make everyone get COVID even more, as though a hair of the dog strategy might work on viruses and you'll never feel its effects if you just have a shot for breakfast. Baker says he'll be voting against the government extending the Coronavirus Act renewal this week, which gives the government emergency powers to enforce lockdowns and give all their friends money to provide glorified bin bags to nurses. It's tricky because really Baker is in some ways right to oppose a bill that allows Boris Johnson to potentially continue to fuck things up, like when the virus first emerged and he said an overreaction to it would do more harm than good, so the UK should just ignore it. I suppose it makes sense for the Prime Minister to assume the virus had the same weaknesses that he did. The PM's former advisor and rejected Funko Pop, Dominic Cummings, appeared in front of the Commons Science and Technology Committee last week and called for an investigation into the government's handling of the coronavirus, as though by pointing and shouting, "Look over there," they might not notice him sneaking away. Cummings, who single-handedly took COVID to Barnard Castle, said that actually the Department of Health were a smoking ruin when the crisis stuck and that they should have had a separate task force just for the vaccine. I presume Dom had pals that had never been in a task force or knew what the vaccine was that would have absolutely been up for doing it. Labour say they won't oppose extending the Coronavirus Act, as that would mean they'd be doing their job and it'd just confuse everyone. So even if Steve Baker and his treehouse of friends don't vote for it, it'll probably still pass. But could it also be that maybe the Prime Minister has finally learned his lesson? I mean, he's chosen very careful language to say that without precaution, the third wave will wash up on our shores from Europe. And that's smart, right? As it should definitely get all those on board who believe COVID is a hoax, but are also terrified by immigration. The Foreign Secretary and eyes like stab wounds in a week-old pie, Dominic Raab, has confirmed that the UK will lift the cap on the number of nuclear warheads in our stockpile, as what he called the ultimate insurance policy against hostile states, presumably because it would mean we could take ourselves out before they do, and that would count as a win in his book, and he'd probably be shouting world-beating as Raab's glistening ham face turned to ash. Considering that the main threat that currently exists in the world is cyber warfare, I do wonder if Raab thinks it's just possible to bomb the internet and that we're mere months away from the government ordering a warhead strike on the wires at the back of the Foreign Secretary's desktop. Only a few months back, Raab said he was committed to stopping Iran from getting more nukes, so maybe his thinking is that by buying them all up first, Iran won't get a chance, as they're not going to bother staying up all night refreshing the Argos page, are they? Oh wait, sorry, that's PlayStation 5's, but it's basically the same. Some people have said it's ridiculous there's no money to give nurses a pay rise, but there's money to pointlessly increase the nukes. But if you think about it, if we launched a nuclear warhead and a nuclear war happened, there'd be no one left for nurses to fix up anymore, or any nurses anymore, or anyone anymore. So really, it's far more cost effective. Meanwhile, the army have been reduced to their smallest size in 200 years, which now I think means they'll be able to effectively fight mice, wasps, and the MOD can save money by transporting them in your pocket rather than big ships or planes. It's rumoured that the government are going to take over Liverpool Council with Housing Minister and loaf of bread for a face, Robert Jenrick, potentially planning to install commissioners to run the historically Labour city. This is due to allegations of corruption, much like the ones against Robert Jenrick for handing his pal Richard Desmond massive tax breaks. Or like how Boris Johnson's failed to declare £60,000 that was donated to him to do up his Downing Street flat. Or like how it was found out this week that former Prime Minister and deflated balloon David Cameron lobbied the Chancellor and Spring Onion, Rishi Sunak, for £400 million of government help to a company that then went bust. But hey, how else to prove that his years of massive cuts to public funding was necessary than by proving that so much of it is just wasted on completely useless projects? Number 10's new £2.6 million media room was installed by a Russian company who also do work for state-owned Russia Today, and they put in all the cameras, microphones and computers in the facility, just leaving out a picture with moving eyes and a secret room for a man in a Cossack hat to listen in. Downing Street say they have absolutely no security concerns about this being the case, but I suppose why would they, as if anyone got angry about it, they'd find polonium in their tea. So you can see why Liverpoolians might be concerned about the potential government takeover, but I think actually they shouldn't be so hasty, as it could mean an awful lot of money is brought into the city. Well, for at least a few minutes anyway, until it's funneled back out in failed projects and oligarchs' pockets, but hey, at least it visited. A majority of ministers on the Alex Salmond committee concluded that Nicola Sturgeon misled their inquiry as to whether she intervened in the government's harassment allegation against the former First Minister and flesh conker. But an independent inquiry by Ireland's former chief prosecutor, James Hamilton, decided that actually Sturgeon didn't breach the ministerial code, meaning that she now won't be under pressure to resign as First Minister, but at the same time has lost the relevant experience to potentially become Education Secretary, Home Secretary or even Prime Minister. Labour have selected their candidate for the Hartlepool by-election from their very long list of one, and amazingly, against all the odds, that candidate, Paul Williams, won. Labour leader and Dell Optiplex 990 PCN Telcor Keir Starmer said just last month that the selection for Labour election candidates needs to be more democratic, and local party members should be able to select their own candidates. So it's lovely that Labour have adhered to that here by parachuting in an ardent Remainer into a largely Brexit area that had a very narrow Labour win last time, while Paul Williams lost down the road in Stockton. As though everyone that voted for the Brexit party in Hartlepool in 2019 will now think, oh, actually no, what I really wanted was someone who didn't represent me in the slightest and has already been rejected by our neighbours. Paul Williams has already got in trouble after a tweet of his from 2011 emerged where he said, "Do you have a preferred Tory MILF? Mind-blowing dinner conversation." Which puts to rest any concerns by critics that Labour are in bed with the Conservatives when in reality they just wish they were. Williamson also took a state-arranged expenses paid trip to Saudi Arabia where he insists he met modern and progressive people, so good luck to any journalist trying to dig up dirt on him. Labour are concerned about the very progressive and pretty exciting Northern Independence Party taking many of their youth votes in the area. weirder. I mean, you think the kids would be flocking to a party that's showing them how democratic they are by sending in a man who looks like one minute he might be making fresh pasta on This Morning and the next selling your nan for oil while trying to flirt with the Home Secretary. And lastly, BBC Breakfast presenter Naga Manchetti was forced to apologise after laughing at a joke her white male colleague Charlie Stade had made, asking Robert Jenrick if the union flag in his office was a little small compared to his colleagues. It was a fair question, though, as if government ministers really want to represent the country in 2021, they should be massively flagging too. Also, it says a lot that the housing minister is unable to erect a small pole to even half-mast. Boris Johnson is spending nearly £1 million repainting a new Brexit jet in red, white and blue. On one hand, it's a total waste of cash for pointless tokenistic showcasing. But on the other hand, it's nice that finally one of the projects he's spent absolutely millions on will actually take off. And far-right uncooked calzone Tommy Robinson has been found to have spent all of his supporters' donations on cocaine parties and prostitutes. That explains why he was so upset a few years ago having milkshakes thrown at him, because he's far more of a fully skimming guy. Hey, hey, Parpol Broads, how goes you? I am recording this on my agent's third birthday and second lockdown birthday, which you might think is sad, but actually I'm pretty pleased that our flat isn't overrun with sugar-fueled mad toddlers smashing cake into the furniture, and there is part of me wondering if I should just tell her there's a lockdown next year too. I am, of course, joking. Of course there'll be a lockdown next year too. No, I'm not joking. I mean, we had a nice day yesterday, and she's been at nursery today, meaning that me and my wife have celebrated 3 years of parenting by sitting in the complete quiet and just not moving very much. I've written today's show while being so very, very still. It's been really quite something. This is the last podcast for a couple of weeks because I can feel my brain getting to the point where writing jokes is hard, because all I want to do is say, oh, what the fuck, a lot, and call people arseholes instead of writing something clever, as you may have noticed in the intro today. I read a piece yesterday, right, about, I don't know why I read these pieces, I don't know why I do this to myself, but there was a piece yesterday that popped up in my feed about a woman who's an asylum seeker from North Korea and is now running to be a Conservative councillor in Bury because she's quoted as saying, after living in a socialist regime, she couldn't vote for socialists like Labour. And look, hey, I can't imagine what it's like to escape North Korea. She's had a really horrific and depressing life. But I mean, Jesus, reading that gave me a weird mix of wanting to scream, wanting to drive to Bury and shout political definitions into her home through the letterbox, and just sort of sighing a lot, curling into a ball and giving up on humanity. I mean, look, not that you need me to go through this, but North Korea isn't socialist. It's a monarchy-led authoritarian state filled with corruption and many elements of fascism, but it pretends to have the premise of communism by sticking a hammer and sickle up all over the place. Secondly, Labour isn't socialist. They're currently social democrats, if that at all. And then the idea that you might be an asylum seeker in the UK and think the best people to represent you are the Conservatives is akin to being a fox and thinking the best people to represent you in the country are Conservatives. I mean, look, is it a lack of awareness of political ideals? Is it just that no one fucking cares anymore and can't even be bothered to try? Is it that all of this is sewn up and we should just go and live on Sealand as a tiny independent island? I don't know. The fact is, I should probably just spend 2 weeks not thinking about it for a while in order to stop asking my wife all these questions while she tries to watch and enjoy Drag Race. So, this week, big thank you tons to Taz and Connell who donated to the Ko-fi, which, oh my God, it's appreciated this week, as it appears the self-employed support that I thought we were getting this month, because it's from Feb to April, is now not arriving till May. So thanks for that, Rishi Sunak. I do hope that it comes with a time machine so I can actually pay my rent for the months that it's meant to be supporting me in. Jesus Christ, either that or I'm going to have to send him an invoice with added interest. Just Jesus. So that's why I'm not even going to enter this podcast for the British Podcast Awards this year, so because I can't afford it. It's like £30 plus VAT per entry per category, which is just a bit too much. But on the plus side, it does mean that when this podcast doesn't get nominated for anything, it's just because I don't have the funds rather than because the judges think it's shit like most years, so it'll be a nice change. Anyway, so if you fancy supplementing me where the government aren't, I mean, isn't that the future of all our lives, then please do throw a pound or two at the ko-fi.com/parpolbro, joining the patreon.com/parpolbro, or via the Acast supporter button, or, you know, failing that, buy something at British Boxers using the discount code, or just tell everyone you know to listen in and give the show a nice shiny review so other people might give it a try and sort of mix laughing with shouting fuck's sake even more into their day. I mean, that's basically what this is. So, some quick admins for you this week. Firstly, this Friday, March the 26th, I'm part of a lovely bill on an online Quantum Leopard gig raising money for Sisters Uncut. I should say it's not endorsed by Sisters Uncut, but it is for them, if it makes sense. Anyway, I'm on with Sikisa, Chloe Petz, Sarah Keyworth, Sarah Baron and James Ross, who are all very, very funny people indeed. And it's going to be really good fun. Tickets, I'll pay what you want and I'll pop a link into the podcast blurb too. Also, regular pod helper Cat Day has narrated this week's pseudopod, which that's how she says it's pronounced. I'm still not sure. Suedopod? Sodopod? Swadar Pod? One of those. Anyway, it's Swadar Pod, episode 747, entitled Keeping House, and it is a spooky old tale and very much fun, and she's done a great job in narrating it too, so please do give that a listen. And links, of course, be in the wordy bit. And last thing is that on today's show, it's another chat about the media and politics, which I know I've done a few of lately, but it's because there's loads to talk about it, really. I'm very interested in it, and I hope you are too. But when the podcast returns, I'm hoping to do a catch-up on Scottish, Welsh and Northern Irish politics, local elections, mayoral elections, and just more grassroots shiz and other political areas. That's grassroots as in politics, not stuff to do with gardening. I don't want to do an episode on that. Unless you can think of political gardening stuff. I haven't got there yet. Anyway, any suggestions you have for any of those things, send them my way at all the places I'll list later in the show in their usual audio home. And on this week's show, the excellent Dr. Bethany Usher is back to chat to me about the intertwining of celebrity journalism and politics. And plus, in the middle, a teeny mo about vaccine nationalism. Or as I like to call it, vactionalism. No, wait, that's a bit tricky to say, isn't it? Vaxnash. Vaccinalism. Nationalin. Oh, God, I need a break. If I was to say to you, what is the relationship between celebrity and politics, you'd probably immediately think of how every time there's political fundraisers for good causes, loads of really cool artists and musicians turn up, but every time the Conservatives do one, it's just Gary Barlow, and then he sings a song that sounds like a small rodent is being washed down a very large drain, and he pretends he pays taxes. But actually, the notion of celebrity, as in someone who gets public attention, appeals to many politicians. Not just in the way that many of us know who they are enough to swear at the TV when they're on, but also in the way in which the press feels it's important for us to know details about their personal lives, such as how many kitchens they have, or if their relatives they have no connection with anymore once thought about skipping a bus fare, or when it comes to Conservatives, how it's none of your business how many kids they have, but don't they rugby tackle children well? If journalism created and is driven by celebrity culture, has celebrity culture and journalism in turn driven our politics into a wall while on a cocktail of drugs? I probably don't really need to ask this, as we all wonder why so many vote so selfishly, and then you turn on the TV to see normal people aren't even allowed to win a washing machine on a game show anymore, as a celebrity has to have a go to win money for a charity that they otherwise wouldn't bother helping. We are unfortunately invested in stories and narratives as human beings, and by giving political stories a human side, that makes readers become more invested and, of course, distracted from how many of the subjects aren't actually people at all, but are giant lizards. Huh. Politics, celebrity and journalism are three sides of a weird coin that only rich people have, but will it ever change? And more importantly, are there ways to adapt to it or work with it to mean that we're not forever stuck with a Prime Minister who is a former journalist and therefore knows just how to persuade people he has a personality, rather than the reality of his entire being is just three repeated stories bellowed into a bin, followed by whatever the last person in the room told him to say? Recently on this podcast, I've had quite a few pod chats about the media side of politics, as I think it's such a major force in all of it, whether we like it or mostly not. Three episodes ago, it was Dr. Chris Roberts on the state of British political media, and last episode was Helen O'Hara on the sexism within the film industry. This week, to wrap it all up, I spoke to the brilliant journalist, writer and academic Dr. Bethany Usher. Last time Bethany was on this show, many moons ago, she superbly explained attack journalism and its history. Recently, she's released a new book, Journalism and Celebrity, that looks at how celebrity journalism came to be and the effect that it's had on both society and politics from the 1800s to today. I asked her all about how our obsession with celebs affects the way we vote and the way we digest news, and also why it's always Gary Bloody Barlow for the Tories. OK, I didn't actually ask the last one. Actually, to be perfectly honest, the first half of the interview is very much about Bethany's recent research area, and then due to my tangential question asking, the second half is a chat that's more focused on the political lot we're stuck with and just why on earth people fall for their stick. It was great to get Bethany back on the show and talk to her again, so I do hope you enjoy. Here is Bethany. Hi, Bethany. It's really nice to have you on the podcast again. And this time asking you about something that I mean, it feels incredibly relevant over the past few weeks, not just in the way that politicians have been kind of heralded by certain newspapers, despite their foibles, many, many awful foibles, but also with things like the royals and that scenario. And I wanted to ask you, you know, how is the notion of celebrity intertwined with journalism? And I suppose more personally to this podcast, why and how does that involve politics and politicians?
Well, so the origins of democracy and capitalism in the UK find their roots in the 18th century and in relationship to the 18th century London-based and then eventually more regional-based press as well over the course of the century and into the next century. So right from the origins, when you have the revolutionary debate of the 18th century, the arguments for greater democracy, the inclusion discussions, the first inclusions of ordinary people within political and public spheres, you also have the consumer revolution, where people for the first time have disposable incomes and are buying more goods, and the boom of literacy. So by the end of the century, about 50% of the British population are literate. And those things uniquely combined in the British press to create both the idea of political journalism and the idea of celebrity journalism. Right from their origins, they are together. They are both evident in the newspapers of those period, but also really intertwined. So you have, for example, very big celebrities, huge celebrities of their day, such as Georgiana, Duchess of Devonshire, who's kind of the first multimedia celebrity that we have. She's got consumer goods that she sells. She is an author. She is a darling, she's a fashionista, the darling of the press, or of the liberal, the Whig press. And she's also political. And that takes wings. It takes place eventually. What she does is actually start campaigning for the Whig Party on the streets of London. And there's all these accounts of her kissing babies and drinking ale in houses. And she designs a set of Whig coloured fans to be sold at the hustings. And so you've got this idea of the celebrity campaigner really emerging very, very early on in the kind of end of the 18th century. Earlier than that, you have, for example, the revolutionary debaters. And I think last time on the podcast, we talked about Thomas Paine, but he is also very much as a celebrity. And by surviving newspaper records, there is more content that discusses him in a personal term than there is actually writings about his political pamphlets in what we have that's surviving from this time. And that includes kind of accounts of his personal life, suggestions around his sexuality and his friendships with other men, references to his trousers being found in water closets, accusations he's a thief, all of these kind of sort of personalised and scurrilous attacks which are linked to undermining his political work, and also accounts that celebrate him, you know, that talk about his relationships with friends in positive terms, how that's impacted political change too. So they've never been separate. The worlds of journalism, celebrity and politics are just intertwined from their origins. And they are the ways in which the press, the creation of celebrity was one of the ways by which the press tried to circulate new ideas about what it meant to be a human, sell goods in relation to the consumer revolution, and also as a way to negotiate and to communicate to audiences, to readers, what was happening in the realm of politics too.
Well, I was going to ask, is it necessary to kind of grab people and get them interested into politics to kind of put that human element into it? Do the newspapers need to say this person's like this because that's the only way that we'll be interested in the story as other human beings? Does it have less grab than just putting the politics as they are or putting the facts as they are?
Well, history would tell us that, yes, it does have greater impact, and that's why politicians do it, that's why they employ PR agents, that's why they perform in certain ways, and that if they do so, newspapers will sell more copies, there will be more clicks, likes and shares. If you look at content now in the digital age, then that kind of hook in becomes more important than ever. And we see when you, for example, if you were to look at content relation to the obvious celebrity politician of our age, Donald Trump. And if you look at the kind of Mail Online content about him, it is not just about a political leader. It's not just a president. It is also about his family life, his children, what they're wearing. It's this whole negotiated and constructed sense of who he is. So there's a reason why that is useful to Donald Trump. It gives him greater publicity in an age where heightened visibility seems to be the number one way by which you gain some form of political or social power. And it's also useful for the Mail Online. They wouldn't keep doing it if it didn't keep getting clicked on, because their algorithms and their kind of response rates from audiences have direct influence on the content of their journalists, that they produce more of what is popular. So the answer to your question is that we've never had a period before where we haven't had this kind of relationship, to different levels and with different moments of heightened activity across the course of the last 320 years. We've never had a period since the origins of the mass media, I should say, which is the 18th century press. Would it? Is the question, isn't it? Is that that's a question for us all, wouldn't it? If we removed this fundamental facet of political reporting, which is the relationship with celebrity culture and the personalization of political figures, would it still communicate to audiences in the same way?
It's a very tricky question, is it? Because I mean, even on my podcast, it's what I use to write jokes about, is all the drama of it. And we spoke to Professor Chris Roberts a few weeks ago, and he was all about how it's all about the, you know, political journalism is all about the drama and not about the reporting of local politics and the local idea of politics. But it's interesting, because I remember last time when you were on a podcast and you were talking about how long ago attack journalism started, and in the same way now you discuss today, how long ago celebrity journalism started. And I think, even in my head, it seems so recent that we've had to have personality politicians, you know, these politicians, especially like Trump or like Boris, who are a big character that they can really play with. And that feels very recent to me. Is there a sort of changing point where everything ramped up and everything became more dramatic and more perhaps over the top in the way it was described? Or is that just me having a very narrow sort of recollection of history?
Well, I think that with each kind of emergence of a mass media or a new form, what you get is an associated boom and a proliferation of new ways to use what are quite old thematic themes, which is heightening the visibility of certain individuals for a commercial or political or social purpose, which has been around forever. So if you have, there's kind of five booms of celebrity culture where you get related to new platforms, where you have an increase or a change that means that it impacts on how politics and politicians are performing to and the way that they are being reported on in journalism. So I've talked about the 18th century, and then you've got the next big one really is the invention of the new journalism of the 1870s onwards, the Victorian era new journalists on both sides of the Atlantic, and the origins of what we would now call tabloid journalism, but also it's the origins of all press. It's things like modern press. It's not just the tabloids, you know, the kind of idea of cross column headlines, of breaks, of fillers, of, you know, the shape of the press changes, and celebrity takes new forms. So they, and so does political journalism too. So in this country, you have T.P. O'Connor and George Nunes, who were both Liberal MPs and journalists, and big celebrities in their own right, you know, massively famous. W.T. Stead, not an MP, obviously, not least because he went to jail for his campaigning journalism, but also an ardent liberal. And they are, in their content that they're producing, the world between celebrity and politics is really, really blurred. So T.P. O'Connor writes magazines, periodicals called Picture Politics, and he talks about dandies in Parliament and the biggest noses in Parliament and the brightly coloured waistcoats of, you know, there's this kind of personal insider tracking to what's going on in Westminster. And then you've got on the same point that, you know, in his columns, for example, which was called Mainly Like People, which was on the front page of The Star, not the same version of The Star we have today. It's a different newspaper. He has the main focus of it as celebrities and politicians. He also focuses on the associated kind of staff of the public, of the kind of media industry, publicists, theatre owners, that kind of thing. And then ordinary people too, so lottery winners from the continent, people who've suddenly become rich, criminals, people who were victims or witnesses of crime, who find themselves in public visibility. And you've got this kind of heady mix of politics and society and celebrity culture and consumer culture all kind of compressed together in this Mainly About People column. So that's the second big boom. Sorry, I digressed a bit there. The third big boom is then, of course, cinema and Hollywood. And then multimedia kind of performances, radio, television, and the associated practices with that. And then particularly in relation to television, then what that becomes is the kind of tabloidism, the neoliberal model of tabloidism that takes hold at the end of the 1970s, or it's kind of been growing to that point, which is this kind of commercialization and selling of self and private world becomes part, a greater part of the performance. And that's linked to kind of new notions of individualism and the individualist in politics. So yes, that neoliberal model of politician, which kind of begins with the Reagan-esque and Thatcher era, something new happens around there. And I think that's what people are seeing, is the shift that they feel like has happened over the last 45 or 50 years. And then, of course, the big fifth change that we are living through, or we have lived through over the last 20 years and we continue to live through, is digital technology and the performance of self. And of course, post really 2008, the social media element of political performance. So where it's performances that happen across multiple platforms at once, but is often centered around self-performance on social media, and then that networks and is represented by other media in different ways. So the answer is both. It's been around forever, but that doesn't mean it hasn't vastly changed, and that you are not identifying that there is something different about this age and there has been, than there has been in ages before.
Is one of the differences, I mean, from the sort of neoliberal kind of tabloids era onwards, is one of the differences that perhaps politicians are aware that they're now celebrities, or more aware of how to play it, and their relationship with the press maybe changed or developed so that they, you know, so that the press played towards the images that they wanted to portray of themselves? Was that a change?
Yeah, I think the big shift around that is that you have, really, when you look at Thatcher and Reagan, who were very different politicians to even someone else. And it always is astonishing to me that they are generationally John F. Kennedy's era, Thatcher and Reagan, that they are born all around the same period. That's their era. But they're, of course, this later age, this kind of completely different historical age, as we look at it. And what you've got then is the greater intertwining between the government and big owners and news conglomerates, and the personal relationship between them, often kind of symbolised by Murdoch's relationship with Thatcher and Reagan. But, you know, other editors absolutely adored her. The Conan Brothers, there's a lot of conversations, the Conrad Brothers, about her, how they adored her, you know, this kind of, this adoration from certain pockets of the press of this political leader. And you've got the boom of corporate communications coming into politics in a huge way. So public relations really becoming a huge facet of the political party structure and how a leader is communicated out to audiences. So yes, the neoliberal era did change things in the relationship with the press between political leaders was one of them. And that's not gone away, of course, is that there is still that intertwined relationship, particularly in the British news between the British news media and, of course, our government, not least our Prime Minister, who was a journalist. And I would say to people, I said in my book that it felt fatalistic, even like fantastical, that when I finished writing my book, the President of the United States was a reality television celebrity. And the Prime Minister of Britain was a journalist, given that my whole argument was that celebrity and journalism and politics were intertwined from their origins, and what was going to be the logical outcome of that. I mean, incredible.
It is so, also when you spell it out like that, it's just so frightening, isn't it, that there's no barrier between all those things right now. I mean, you know, how has it affected our politics? Because, you know, you can see it even, you know, in recent polls between sort of Johnson and Starmer. Starmer's doing very badly in popularity, and So regardless of his politics, which I discuss regularly on the show as well, but, you know, because he's not a very engaging personality, whereas Johnson, whether you like him or loathe him, which mostly the latter for me, but he knows what, you know, it's every day is a different soundbite or a different thing that he said is across all of the front pages. And he very much knows how to play that. And is that, I mean, that must be a big drive for how we're all voting.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And Boris Johnson is a consummate communicator. He is somebody who is able to attract huge amounts of attention just by performing a version of himself or by heightening certain facets of his own personality that puts people in it, many people in ease in a way that other politicians have never been able to do. It's this ability to make people feel easy about what is he's actually saying as he is saying it that is, I think, astonishing. I think that people underestimate the uniqueness of that. In a similar way that there was a uniqueness about Barack Obama. Barack Obama was a star politician. He wasn't just a politician who used elements of celebrity culture. He had this almost, he has this star-like charisma that kind of opened up a new realm of performance of self and performance of political vision that, you know, I know a lot of politicians, if they could bottle it, they would, and, you know, drink it, they would love to have that kind of capacity. And Boris Johnson's isn't the same. He's not a star, and it's not a star-like charisma that he has. It's a kind of buffoonery that makes people feel at ease, that really is just like, they're a part of him that's just like me, that he says the wrong thing sometimes, that he kind of looks a bit unkempt, that, you know, he doesn't mean it when he says something racist. He's just not thinking. It's just because he's authentic in who he is. And I think they underestimate him. I think that Boris Johnson is a very astute propagandist in the same way as other prime ministers in the past who have been journalists are astute propagandists. Churchill would be the obvious one, you know, one of the most astute propagandists of all time. And also, some would argue, thank goodness for it, the propaganda that Britain created during the Second World War to counter fascism in Europe was a powerful narrative. And Churchill really drove that, you know, and this idea of the Blitz spirit of courage and defiance, that we were unified. The royal family is this kind of middle class staying in London, you know, really, really clever stuff. And I think Boris Johnson has something of that capacity and something of that political nous where he is able to make people kind of believe what he's saying on the element of that he's authentic about what he's saying. I would say that it's all part of his political performance, that he knows what appeals to people. He is quite likely, I have guessed, to have had several focus groups across the course of his career where it's discussed. I don't know, I have no evidence of that, but I would be surprised. He would be the only political leader who hasn't had it in modern times. And, you know, he's very good at what he does.
I mean, but it's incredible how, you know, sort of when I think about celebrity journalism, for example, about, you know, about a TV celebrity or about, as we've seen with a lot of the stuff about, say, Meghan Markle recently, which is obviously, you know, race driven. That's a slightly different conversation. But we, you know, when celebrities mess up or they do something badly, they are absolutely pounced on by a lot of the press and often shamed. And with Boris, you know, the difference seems to be that when, for example, we had that big argument with Carrie Simmons and the police were called, it was completely directed away from him. And when we've had all these horrific COVID deaths and we've had all the horror of the past year, you know, it's like Teflon, and there's a lack of shame on his part, but also none of the press is interested in pouncing on it particularly. I say none of the press. I'm absolutely, you know, sort of generalising here. But there's a lack of wanting to pounce on that in the way that we would with TV celebrities or movie celebrities in that same way. So what is the difference there, simply because of money and kind of connections and the biases of political biases of press? Or is there a lack of interest as well from readership about those things?
I think probably, I don't know if it's lack of interest, but I think there's elements of both the audience and the Johnson's unique and the Conservative Party's relationship with the news media at play, that both of those have a factor to play in this. I think that what Boris Johnson kind of has encapsulated is a cultural shift in this country around neoliberalism and its later model, which was progressivism, neoliberal progressivism of the Blairs and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. There's been a rejection of that amongst pockets of the British community. If we kind of stick to Britain for this one, because, you know, America has different facets at play, but there's been a rejection of that from pockets of the British community that would have traditionally voted Labour. So what you have is that you've got neoliberal kind of social and economic values from the 70s and across the 80s, but it's a very conservative vision of it. It's linked to, you know, kind of limitations. If you think, you know, Thatcher was someone's very conservative on gay rights, very outspoken about single parents, you know, that this was a social conservatism, quite, you know, quite by our standards, I would say quite right wing social conservatism. And then Blair and Bill Clinton in America, Barack Obama, but it's the influences here too, tie that neoliberal economic system to this idea of progressive politics, so that we are going to be more tolerant. Now, that made political sense, as well as I do believe that was the generational difference between him and Thatcher, is that I do think that he did believe this stuff. But also at the time, it made sense because people were ready for that kind of alternative social vision, you know, and so it was an astute political move too. But when you, and David Cameron largely stayed with that vision of this kind of neoliberal sort of progressive, but he was more financially, you know, moving more financially, fiscally right wing, the neoliberal model. He didn't rock the boat vastly, David Cameron, from that progressive vision. But of course, when the 2008 economic disaster happened, there was a rejection of people who were suffering of that economic vision, that this huge swathes of the population were left behind. And the version that was before them at that time was also tied to progressive politics. And I think that people, but in rejecting the inequalities they were feeling in their lives, also ended up rejecting some of these progressive models too. And into that kind of time of discussion and debate, or were feeling that was linked, that at the same time as you are arguing for the greater rights of these people and these people and these people, and that's the focus, you know, I am economically bereft. So it became linked in people's minds, and into that debate and into that kind of mess, while we were trying to figure all of that out, stepped Boris Johnson, Brexit, and then, you know, stepped the Brexit debate, Boris Johnson to fill it, and people like Nigel Farage becoming more popular, who kind of fed that narrative to them, said they were right. And so there is, if you think about it that way, does it mean that if people reject Boris Johnson, do they feel like they are also, you know, kind of accepting that they are worth less in their minds to others? It's a very complex thing, but it's an indication of a lot of different events, political and social and economic events, combined with changes to media cultures, combined with the rise of social media and the instantness of it in terms of our news agendas, and also a political figure who is a trained journalist and knows how to create a narrative. And that's why I think he has become so difficult to pin anything on, I think, for the for the critical British media. But, you know, a lot of the media don't want to either. They are that Boris Johnson fits very well with that conservative neoliberalism of the 80s and early 90s that underpinned tabloid culture and still, you know, kind of underpins tabloid cultures to this day. He's a good person to represent it for them in the same way that Margaret Thatcher was a good person to represent it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And we'll be back with Bethany in a minute, but first... The thing about global pandemics, right, is that they're global, yeah? I mean, Dominic Raab may struggle to understand that there's anywhere beyond the sea, but over the past 12 months, COVID has done far more travelling than any of us will get to do. 2.7 million people worldwide have now died from it, which is the equivalent to the population of a place with 2.7 million people in it. You Google it, I'm not your dad. Now, in an ideal world, you know, like one in a multiverse somewhere where instead of us humans, they've got ones who've got milk cartons for heads and they actually embrace sharing and kindness but also shit out of their knees and speak in cow. Wait, sorry, I've gone too far with this analogy. I mean, in an ideal world, vaccines would also be global. Hooray! Vaccines were made. Surely everyone will just knock COVID on the head in a year and we can all get on with our lives like we did with tuberculosis, which has nearly been eradicated from everywhere in the globe, absolutely everywhere except the global south, including tons of developing nations. Or like we did with AIDS. Oh, no, wait. Sorry, not that one. Oh, look, here's the thing with the COVID vaccinations. All of the big rich countries, including the UK, which is gradually sliding down the scale, have snaffled all the vaccines for themselves, blocking aid for smaller countries until they've fixed their own, aka the airplane oxygen mask system. The US said back in February it was their people first, then India slowed down on exporting their vaccine, and now the EU aren't willing to share either until they've got all jabbed up. The UK were meant to be getting all our vaccine from our own country and some from the EU, but now we're suddenly buying lots of India's too, around 10 million doses that were thought to be for poorer nations. Though, of course, the UK's vaccine minister and style icon for Butlin's magicians, Nadeem Zawahi, insists that they've got assurance that it won't affect India's commitment to send 300 million doses to lower and middle-income countries, all the while India's own supply isn't actually reaching its own poorer citizens as they have to register online but have no access to the internet. It's a completely unequal game, becoming increasingly more unequal as vaccines get bought up, meaning the supplies cost more and many countries can't afford them. There is also the issue of patents, meaning that only certain countries can develop them, and of course the issue of costly resources and the knowledge they need to make them. The US, UK and EU have all blocked patents from being dropped because the drugs industry said it would stop its ability to invest in future COVID treatments and other illnesses. Yeah, basically, they don't want to stop making money off people getting unwell, and sadly there's no cure for greed yet, and if there was, they'd probably patent it and only sell it to the highest bidder. According to the drug industry reps, eliminating patent protections would undermine the global response to the pandemic. And yes, I guess it would, as it'd just show how selfish many countries are and that it's entirely not necessary to be. The big worry is that fewer organisations and companies would work on vaccines because there'd be less money in it, and they wouldn't want to save people if it didn't mean they could also buy a Beamer. So it could, horror of horrors, lead to a global effort to make people healthier because of kindness, and that would really dick up how everything everywhere works. The World Health Organization is trying to work around this with a system called COVAX, which sounds a lot like a Marvel villain. And that means the G7 fund that scheme instead of sending vaccines to countries direct, all of which is helpful, but not as helpful as it would be were all these companies and countries deciding to take on the teacher person to fish ethos, but with vaccines, as fish really wouldn't help right now. But sadly, that's the way it is, because people everywhere are shits. So this means that the vaccines are all getting political up in here. Russia and China, for example, are sending loads of vaccines directly to Africa, because many countries on that continent are now booming in the tech industry, and the Russians and Chinese really want their fingers in those Raspberry Pis. In the UK, we've got all up in India's vaccine grill, because they're going to be the third biggest economy pretty soon, and that's going to be real nice for the trades in the future. And if anything, I suppose, this does mean that the UK might possibly, maybe, be more generous with vaccine donations around the world in the hope that tit for tat, post-COVID and Brexit, we might occasionally be sent a tomato or something from somewhere else. Boris Johnson said that 80% of the UK's surplus is going to get donated around the world, but as we might now have a slowdown in our supply through April, that's 80% of not very much at all. French President and smug beaver Emmanuel Macron said 5% of France's vaccines will be donated too, which critics have actually said is nowhere near enough. The thing is, if poorer countries don't get vaccines, then old COVID's going to run rampant there. Not only can it mean more casualties and deaths in the places people conveniently pretend don't exist until they accidentally see about them on the news, but it also means that the coronavirus gets more goes to mutate and create variants that could then end up back here, which means different vaccines would need to be made, things will be shut down, borders are closed, trade's all screwed again, everything will be awful, and all of us finally complete Netflix. So, the choice is either everyone gets vaccines, or we all stay with COVID as the one true globally uniting entity, achieving what no other superpower has and ruling over us all and arguably forcing in more socialist progressive measures than any of our political parties might. Oh wait, maybe COVID wants to mutate to become the cure for greed. Ah no, actually no, then Boris Johnson wouldn't have survived it, would he? No, ignore me, my theories are trash. And now, back to Bethany. Yeah, I think one of the things that fascinates me is, I suppose, just as a public member, as an audience of all this media, you know, it's sort of I feel like I understand why the press portrays Boris in a certain way, and my lack of understanding is always why people refuse to look around that or look at the other elements of it, and I wonder if a part of it is. Well, is, you know, with everything you're discussing and we mentioned earlier, it's about having that human story to drive things or having a sort of celebrity to drive things. Is that why, you know, we're not interested in politics unless it has a human story, unless it has a person behind it or a drama behind it? You know, there's a lot of localised important political issues that are going on right now that are being largely ignored, but they'd have to be portrayed in facts and figures. And does that just not have a grab with people anymore now that we're embedded in this world of celebrity political journalism?
I don't think it's binary like that. I don't think that it's because of celebrity that we have that other thing. As I say, that, you know, across the course of history, celebrity culture has equally really affected significant political change by humanizing personal stories, you know, political stories, by attracting attention, by involving ordinary people in politics as a system. You know, that the place of celebrity in that process of involvement is really, really important. So I don't think that it's that it's because we're all looking over there, you know, Britney Spears, we're not looking over there at Keir Starmer. You know, that I don't think is the case. I think that we have really, really narrow sets of news that makes mainstream news media, that we are unfortunately haven't got the investment. If you're talking about local level, we just don't have the level of investment we need in the local press to be able to put the resources in to do those issues to the best of their ability. So those big pieces that you're saying is that if they need to produce 10 web stories a day, then the crime story from the local police, the school teacher story, that these are quicker ways of producing content that's going to be shared on their local Facebook groups and communities. What we have now, of course, though, as well, is there is just a greater competition for attention across all of our attentions, that, you know, that there's never been a unifying media in the way that people think, that, you know, that everybody, single person in the country was focused on one thing. But there have been times of unification through media events that grab the consciousness and we think of that as associated at the time. But now we don't have any sense of that unification in that way. The most likely part of that is the tabloid, still the tabloid press. And that's because it is the most likely to be shared in terms of our news media. It is the most likely to be discussed on broadcast news media or in other ones, the front pages of newspapers. And it is most likely to still get contact, direct contact with politicians. And so when you've got a situation in our country where the popular press is by and large supportive of our government, is that its political leanings ally with our current government, then the amount of information that ever even crosses the timelines or the consciousness of the public is limited, so that they're not look. It's not crossing their paths, the stuff that you and I see, because we've stuck out that path.
So is that why, you know, for example, Marcus Rashford, who did that amazing thing of highlighting food poverty for children and highlighting the need for free school meals. Is that why he cut through? Because he was already a celebrity. He was already being reported by in the press because of his football accolades and the fact that everyone, you know, obviously football is a massive industry in itself. Is that the only way that this news is going to come through, is if we have celebrities like that kind of push it forward?
I think that that's really important. And I think that, you know, celebrities will have usually a very, very well-considered personal brand communication strategy and building strategy. That, you know, that there will be several, if you're talking about any major celebrity, there will be other people who advise them in some way around how to manage their image, how to build their brand in whichever way that it is. I'm talking about mainstream celebrities here, you know, kind of social media influencers and that micro celebrity world can work differently. But those big name ones, and I think that a lot of celebrities should spend as much time developing a brand around their ethical values. What is it that matters to me? What am I going to speak out about? How am I going to do that? That if we had more of that thought and consideration given to what the social value of their brand was, as well as the economic value of their brand, and that level of kind of input and consideration, then you would have more Marcus Rashfords. And I think that Marcus Rashford it's a unique kind of authenticity because it's also something he's really lived. So it feels authentic too. It doesn't feel like a celebrity jumping on the bandwagon. It feels like a part of his human story. So just because celebrities also speak out doesn't mean it would always be as resonant as Marcus Rashford. But then I suppose there's at the core of me, I'm a bit of an idealist who thinks that if you've got a platform, you should use it to affect positive social change in your world. And, you know, not everybody agrees with me on that. But I'd certainly argue at the end of my book that in the conclusion, I argue were a series of things of what's to be done essentially to make it better. So what could we do in terms of press regulation, in terms of the training of students, you know, of journalists, and in terms of what we might do as individual audience members, you know, to kind of make cultures healthier, and also what kind of strategies celebrities could do to more meaningfully use their platform and voice.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. I think it's so important for people to do that. And I do wonder if, as you say, that's one of the ways that things may change in the future, is if more celebrities who aren't politicians perhaps kind of use their platform to be political. And I wonder, sort of, you know, you mentioned a few ways there that obviously you say in your book. I wondered what if there are direct things that listeners can do now about changing, you know, the future. And also just if you think it's likely to change anyway. It sounds like if we've had sort of 320 years of celebrity-focused journalism, it doesn't sound like that's going to change in any way, if that's the way it's always been. But is there a chance that maybe, And no, we'll just get bored of it. I say this is a very personal thing, because I really get bored of celebrity news, and I find that if a panel shows all celebrities, whatever, oh, I can't be bothered, you know. And is there that kind of fatigue that may kick in and change things too?
Well, we'll see, won't we? I don't know. It does not show any signs of abatement. What I think is more likely to happen is that there will be a new way that celebrity culture is performed and communicated, in the way that there has been other ways in the past, and that will negate your boredom for a while. They're not yours, but there will be a new form of it, or something that holds your interest. I think that audience members have a really important role in to play in combat some of the most damaging aspects of celebrity journalism and celebrity culture, particularly. And we've talked about it before, which is around cultures of attack. I think that audiences just need to learn to suck the oxygen out. That this, if we're thinking about the Be Kinder campaigns and all of those kind of things, they're all really well and good. And I completely agree that we should be kinder. But if your Be Kinder message also subtweets an attack, the attack on that individual, you are still giving it oxygen and perpetuating that attack on them. And I don't think people have the awareness of that, don't subtweet it, don't keep repeating the attack. You can show solidarity without doing so. And so I would say that audience members could do that. I think that we're... 12 months ago or 2 years ago even, I might have been in a different place with this. But as things stand, and this is the depressing bit, I think it's going to get worse before, hopefully, down the line, it's going to get any better. And that's because of the changes we are about to see in terms of Ofcom. I don't see the IPSO Code of Practice tackling issues of attack journalism still in any meaningful way, regardless of the very high-profile tragedies we've had, and the ongoing debate, a constant debate about it, that isn't at the moment changing press regulation. The government paper on online harms came out this time last year, and its recommendations were not what I would have done. And also this idea of putting it underneath the banner of Ofcom, and then we are all waiting to see who the new head of Ofcom is going to be, who's going to put all of this stuff together. I think that the potential impact on broadcast journalism is vast of that, and that cultures of celebrity, of the celebritisation of politicians, of greater political partisanship, of greater cultures of attack on people who disagree with progressive visions of politics. I think that they're all potentially going to get worse over the next kind of period of time, which can become a bit depressing. I'm not going to lie, that there's moments where I really have to think about the level of my own engagement with this world, because it is easier, and this is the using your platform to do good thing, this feeds into what I think so many celebrities are frightened to do so, or public figures are frightened to do so, is that it is difficult to put your head above the parapet in such a toxic atmosphere that Marcus Rashford gets abuse to, that we, as well as praise, and that when you are watching it all unfold, sometimes you feel like the best thing for me to do is to just take a step back and concentrate more on my own personal world than the noise that is going on outside of it. And it's, I think it's tough times. I think that, that we have to acknowledge that it's really, really toxic, difficult times at the moment in terms of our public sphere and the place of the personalisation of public figures within it.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's also that sort of thing at the moment where people respond so, they feel that they have to say something all the time and they respond so quickly, and then often it's ill thought through and everyone jumps on it and it can be equally as destructive. And that's the sort of social media has demanded an immediate response from everyone. Why hasn't this person spoken about it? And actually that allows no time to digest it, think about it, think about what a measured or you know, thoughtful response would be. And I find that quite scary at times.
And there's no room to make mistakes. Mm. And there's no room to politically grow or socially grow. And to, you know, I am not the same person that I was when I was 20. But my social political understanding of the world is very different. I think about back to, you know, university days and debates in the Union and Free Speech Society. I was involved in a Free Speech Society when I was at university, which then had very different meanings to me than something called a Free Speech Society probably would now. You know, and I think that I'm really grateful there wasn't social media at that time. Because where's the space to make mistakes and learn and grow from things now? I think it would be a much better debate and discussion to have than these lazy terms such as cancel culture or woke. That these are really lazy terms by which we can't even have conversations about, because it becomes so binary, it becomes so either you're right or wrong. We can't even have conversations about where is the space for apology? Where is the space to grow? Where is the space to think and to learn better? And I mean, that's the risk here, isn't it? Is that social media doesn't afford that.
No, it doesn't afford that. And it's also brief as well. It's always such a, you know, such a limited amount of words, and everyone always, you know, reads it in the tone of voice they choose to. I wondered as well just what you think, you know, just sort of wrap up really, but we've had the big announcement of the brand new media room at Number 10, which is going to be very US style. We've seen the picture that, I don't know if you know, it has a Henry Hoover in the corner. And it's all, you know, it's all set up for these big announcements like they do at the White House. And I mean, is that just sort of celebritizing the idea of politics even more? And I suppose narrowing is going to narrow where we get our news from more, does it?
Yeah, I did see that, because actually the journalist who took a picture at IT and News is a former student of mine called Nathan Lee. And Nathan and I went to Greece together to work on some content around the refugee crisis and a campaign. So I know him. So he's a friend as well as a graduate. I hope he's listening. Hi, Nathan. So I saw the picture. I was laughing at it. He works for ITN now. What we're seeing, of course, that is a presidential system of communication that we are importing. And Boris Johnson's popularity make him almost the perfect person to import that system. It's not something I'm particularly surprised about. I'm more surprised that we didn't get one during the Blair years, actually, is that it would seem to me that it would have been quite the perfect thing for, you know, that Tony Blair and Alistair Campbell might have quite liked that kind of media sort of kind of thing where they could go in and kind of address the media. So I think it's been a long time coming, that kind of setup. Do I think that it would make communicating the reality of what is going on in our political system any better? No. Do I think that it will give us anything other than government propaganda? No. But almost there's part of me that thinks we've always had this idea that the conversations between journalists and politicians and the interviews kind of go on behind closed doors, sort of in the corridors of Westminster, that we don't have that public scrutiny over the moment and the questioning themselves. And there's part of me that kind of thinks, actually, having that in a public sphere where the interactions, if it was to reduce down the kind of anonymous kind of quotations, and a source tells me, and that we can have greater visibility of government spokespeople, I think that has the potential to be a positive thing. So I'll try and be kind about it.
That's good.
Money. And I also read that it was a Russian company who's fitted the communications within it. And I am not an anti-Russian xenophobe by any stretch of the imagination, but I did think that it was an interesting point that people raised.
Yeah, it's very curious, especially after the probe into Russian interference last year. That
well, yes. But we've got loads of... It's the bit that, it sounds British jobs for British workers-ish, but if your whole political mantra of a party is this idea of British jobs for British workers, why is so much of what they do, kind of given to foreign companies? That's the bit that, in Russian companies... That's the kind of, I guess, when you were saying why people don't see the stuff around. Like, why do people not just think that? Where's that critical step? It's very interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And, similarly, like the blue passports, we all demanded them, supposedly, and then it was given to a French company to make them. But nobody bothers about the next step. Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. And that's what I mean. That's why I find it so fascinating, all your studies on... Because it is like watching a story, and people are more invested in the characters and the reality of the story or the situations that are happening around it, and people are more interested in it being a personal attack on Boris rather than actually people in our area are all unemployed. There seems to be a barrier to being able to understand how these things are all linked, and not just we're watching some drama.
And on all sides of the political spectrum, all sides of the political spectrum. I mean, I'm from Sunderland originally, and the amount of tweets where I see somebody saying that'll teach Sunderland for voting for Brexit, or they were told, and you're like, you have got zero understanding of the social and political and economic hardships of growing up in Sunderland. I'm from a single parent family. I grew up in social housing largely or private rented, one of the two. And they've just got absolutely zero kind of understanding of the reality of what caused people in that area to vote for Brexit. And then, but they're not willing to even negotiate or to discuss that. That's not what they want to talk about. What they want to talk about is ha-ha, or this idea of idiot Northeasterners or idiot people from Sunderland. And it just infuriates me that if you want to look for one of the reasons that Brexit happened, if that's the kind of thing you're coming out with, look in the mirror. Because you didn't stand up for people who were being completely forgotten and left behind in this country under successive governments, not under just the Conservative government by any stretch of the imagination. I was one of the people, because my mum's a teacher, my mum trained me, became a teacher, who my family saw circumstances improve vastly under the Blair years in terms of the amount of money there was, in terms of my mother's status, the investment that was put in education at that time. So I was personally lucky, but there were lots of people left behind there. Lots of people left behind in Sunderland who did not reap the benefits of the economic boom, but had to suffer the consequences of the economic downfall. So we do have to think of, but so when we say that, why are we not looking around? Why do the people who love Boris Johnson not look around the kind of extenuating information or the extenuating thing around the government? That happens, to people in the liberal, in the centrists and leftists too, that they don't look enough around what's going on.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's something I brought up on I'll try not to repeat myself, but I think I mentioned it on a podcast a few weeks ago. But just I did a number of shows in Barnsley not long after all the Brexit vote, and Barnsley was repeatedly vox popped as 59% or whatever voted Brexit, and it would only ever vox pop people who go, "We hate immigrants." Well, and I would regularly have these big audiences coming to shows going, "We didn't vote for Brexit, and we're really sad about it." The city was far more nuanced but they did have big issues with unemployment, big issues of industry leaving, and there were various things about, none of this was reported. It was all just this city voted Brexit and nothing else about it, and it was very frustrating.
And if you're feeling like that, then Boris Johnson being kind of on your side is an appealing thing, isn't it? Mm. You know, if you're feeling that you know, that Remainer MPs on parties that you politically voted for maybe in the past kind of are seeing you as the blame for what's gone wrong here, because you voted for Brexit because you were, you know, for whatever reason that you voted for it, you know, whether rightly or wrongly. He's very appealing, you know, he's very good at kind of fitting into that space and giving somebody who people, for whatever reason, even if he is or isn't, feel is on their side. I mean, clever. He's very good at that.
Ugh. Yeah, so annoying. Oh, I know, so annoying giving credit for something, isn't it?
I think Boris Johnson is a really important prime minister that we will look back and think in terms of the impact that he had on British society and culture, and how that happened, the kind of relationship with the news media, the putting in of people into Ofcom, the, you know, the changes to the BBC, that, you know, Boris Johnson is a very, very busy, impactful prime minister, just in ways that people aren't really seeing. Yet, I think.
It's one of the things that I do think is, you know, there's lots of talk about him resigning because he's knackered or he's not earning enough money or whatever. But if that happened, whoever replaced him wouldn't carry off this horrific raft of policies in the same way. I don't think the public would take it from Michael Gove in the same way.
No, you know. I think you're right. I think that the Conservative Party know that they haven't got, there isn't another Boris Johnson, you know, in who has the same kind of appeal, particularly to working class voters. And the ones that are trying to have that kind of thing don't have his ability to carry it off. So if you look at, it's Ben Bradley, is it? Is it Macclesfield, yeah. MP for Macclesfield? I want to say Macclesfield. I could be wrong on that. There is an element of Boris Johnson in his performance. He kind of tries to attract people with the same kind of sound bites and wearing and kind of stance taking. But he doesn't have the charm to carry it off in the same way. And that's the thing about Boris Johnson. There's an effortless charm about him and people find him funny. And that is unique, I think, in British politics at all. I don't think there's anybody with that set unique set of talents that is making him so successful.
I'd say as a comedian, it drives me nuts. I can see through all of it. It's horrible.
Yes.
He'd be a terrible actor if he was at a gig with us.
And I don't find him funny. Yeah. I mean, but that's not my kind of sense of humour. It's that, you know, that kind of self-effacing kind of sense of humour. This is no way linked to Boris Johnson in any way, shape or form. I just want to make that clear. But I'm a big fan of Orson Welles, and he talks about Woody Allen once, where he says that his kind of affected self-effaciveness, kind of self-deprecating attitude sets his teeth on edge. Mm. That it's so arrogant, he says it's so arrogant because it's such a performance and like that he just can't bear it. And I love that because he's this kind of grander than life kind of commentator on celebrity culture in his own right, and completely opposite performance of Woody Allen, and I can see why. But it's that kind of thing for me. I don't find that kind of sense of humour funny. It's not my instinct. So I wouldn't find it funny. I wouldn't find that attractive, I don't think, if it was on the left either. It's not.
No.
It's not something that appeals to me personally, but I do understand why people like him. I do understand why it works for so many.
What a shame. It's such a shame, isn't it? I should also say Ben Bradley's MP for Mansfield, although, I mean, he's not normally bothered about facts, but I'll put it in for my sake and my own.
I'm sorry, Ben Bradley. I really apologise.
But as I said, based on his tweets and comments,
to the people of
I feel like it was only fair that you got something about him wrong, and we shouldn't have corrected it, really. We should have given him a taste of his own medicine. Anyway, Beth, it's so lovely. Thank you for coming back on the podcast. And I asked you this before when you spoke to me brilliantly about attack journalism a little while ago. But, you know, apart from yourself and, of course, your book all about journalism and celebrity, who else? Who else would you recommend? Who else are you currently reading, listening to about, not just about the history of journalism and celebrity, but also informative and alternative news resources?
Oh, okay. So I'm going to be really honest here, and I get my source of news is Twitter, and so I'm going to give you some Twitter accounts that I follow. The obvious one is the Celebrity Studies and the CMCS, Celebrity Research Group. They are really, there's a lot of really interesting podcasts and conversations and stuff that come are shared via that means. In terms of interesting people to follow, I've got two colleagues who I work with a lot in Australia who are part of the Persona Studies Research Farm and Persona Research Consortium. David Marshall, whose book Celebrity and Power is kind of one of the seminal texts around celebrity culture. And Kim Barber, B-A-R-B-O-U-R, who is a Persona Studies academic and does a lot of really interesting stuff around female activists and their online personas and how that draws from elements of celebrity culture in new and interesting and dynamic ways. I have a colleague, Chris Stokel-Walker, who's wrote a book on YouTubers and on TikTok, who is a journalist, and he writes prolifically on news media and media cultures and technology, whole host of issues. So he is really worth a follow too. And then I think that in terms of news media, I think that there's Pippa, oh, I've forgotten her name, one second, Pippa from the Daily Mirror.
Oh, Pippa Carrera.
Yeah, and I still love Susie Boniface, the Fleet Street Fox. I think that they are, you know, from the tabloid kind of stable, but they're both really great journalists on Twitter. You know, they have a great way of kind of mixing information and entertainment and finding, of course, in Pippa's case, brilliant political exclusives. So of the tabloid women, you know, let's not forget them. There's some fantastic female tabloid journalists out there.
Thanks to Bethany for coming back on the podcast. You can find her on Twitter at Bethany Usher, and her book Journalism and Celebrity is available via Routledge.com. It is an academic text, so as always the case with those, it ain't cheap, but do grab a copy if you can. And I shall pop a link in the podcast blurb. I'm going to try and have some interviews that are focused on Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland and the local and mayoral elections when this gets back from its break. But also, I'm keen to hear what other areas of politics you need to hear about right now, or in fact, which ones you definitely don't. Let me know at ParpolBro on Twitter, the Partly Political Broadcast group on Facebook, the contact page at partlypoliticalbroadcast.co.uk, or email me at partlypoliticalbroadcast@gmail.com. Or just write it on a really big flag and it'll end up being in the background of some cabinet minister's interview on telly as they lie about things. Sadly, I'll be too busy swearing at the TV to pay attention to what it actually says. So, as always, probably just best to email, isn't it? And that's all for this week's Partly Political Broadcast podcast, and in fact this month's, and a tiny bit of next month's, because, well, hey, we all need a break, right? And I hope you manage a small break too. Go and celebrate Easter and remember when a giant chocolate rabbit was killed and then came back and we let our children eat them or something. I don't know, those paganistians or Craiganigans were cray-cray and religion really confuses me. If you feel like you might miss the show over the next 2 weeks, then hey, why not listen to old episodes? Tell everyone how much you like it, use the time to review the show, or even just bribe me to release bonus content by donating to the Ko-fi, Patreon or Acast supporter sites so that I can buy chocolate bunny idols and sacrifice them into my face. Dobry den to Acast, my brother Last Skeptic, Cat Day and Katie Coxall, and this will be back in a few weeks when the third COVID wave washes up on our shores and Priti Patel personally tries to detain it for several hours before asking police to come in and hit it, causing more than half the force to have to self-isolate and some protesters in Poole to get away with writing arse across a statue of Robert Baden Powell. Bye! This week's show is sponsored by the Lord Bethel Topless Calendar, featuring the pallid, grey-skinned Lord removing his top and exposing his corpse in a TV show body in a dozen exotic sexy locations. Lord Bethel Topless buying crisps at the petrol station. Lord Bethel Topless sitting on the train. Lord Bethel topless using the recycling centre. Lord Bethel topless making people feel ill in a cafe as he eats a sandwich. Lord Bethel topless causing people to call the police in the park. The Lord Bethel topless calendar for all your cutting down on eating needs.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.